Welcome to the Up Close Podcast, your home for conversations about the present and future of public education. Today, we're going to explore a pressing issue facing schools and educators across the country, and that is the struggle to preserve an education curriculum that is inclusive of all communities and backgrounds. If somehow you have not been aware over the past year or so, what comprises education is currently being hotly debated in many states and local communities. What can and what cannot be taught has become a hot topic in school board meetings, among state legislatures, and in the media. And of course, in many instances, this is somewhat of a political football. From critical race theory to book bans to the most recent and egregious action by Florida to ban an AP African American Studies course, there is a concerted and coordinated effort going on not to teach the truth to our nation's students. Among other things that I would share with you, we know that lawmakers in at least 42 states are attempting, and some have succeeded, to pass legislation that will require teachers to essentially lie to students about the role of racism and sexism and oppression in U.S. history. Teachers not permitted to even discuss the history of slavery. But how can one teach honestly about the nature of our society in the U.S. without examining how racial inequality is a systemic legacy in our country's history? Some might say that not to acknowledge the history of race and racism and the history of other forms of country oppression in our country is to deceive children, not to educate them. Understanding our history helps students to understand the roots of inequality in our world today, and the truth gives them the tools to shape a just future. And we're not just talking about the teaching and children learning about the history of oppression, but also about people who have organized and created coalitions across race and class and gender. Some of the organizations whose curriculums have been banned include the 1619 Initiative of the New York Times and the Learning for Justice curriculum of the Southern Poverty Law Center, among many others. So now, as a listener of the Up Close podcast, you know that we don't just simply talk about our concerns as pertains to the preservation and the furtherance of public education in this country, but we are all about putting forth solutions and the people who are leading and creating and making a difference in our schools. So today, joining me to discuss how we address this rising trend are two nationally acclaimed educators and friends of the NEA Foundation who are focused on helping educators to teach truth through their curriculum. First, we have with us Monica Washington, who is a decorated educator for more than two decades. She has received multiple awards from a wide variety of organizations for her leadership, for her advocacy, for her classroom instruction, including winning Texas Teacher of the Year in 2014. And I have just learned, just last month, Monica was inducted into the National Teacher Hall of Fame. And the crowd went, yeah. Sorry, everyone. Also joining us today is Takeru Nagiyoshi, or TK as most call him, and I will today. TK has received the Horace Mann Award for Teaching Excellence, the Suleiman Excellence in Teacher Leadership Award, and he also was named the Massachusetts 2020 Teacher of the Year. He currently serves as Professional Learning Director of Community Events at Panorama Education, whose mission is to improve student outcomes by helping schools and districts to act on data. He's also a nationally recognized educator and facilitator whose work and voice have been featured in places such as This American Life, The Nation, The Smithsonian, and The Federal Reserve Bank, TK? Interesting. So as you can tell, everyone, we are really privileged and honored today to have these two educators with us to talk about this rather complex topic. Together, both Monica and TK are also a part of the inaugural Voices for Honest Education Fellowship, which is a new initiative that was created by INSTOI, the National Network of State Teachers of the Year, and the Education Civil Rights Alliance. They, alongside three other educators, are fellows working to preserve access, inclusion, and meaningful content in course curriculum so that every student has the opportunity to succeed and to thrive. Long introduction today, everyone, but here we go. Let's dive into this topic. First of all, welcome Monica and TK.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is our great pleasure, and I'm so thrilled to have you on for this conversation because I know that you both deeply care about education justice and inclusion. So I want to just take a moment and set the table for what we're going to talk about. Could you tell me a little bit about, first of all, what is the Voices for Honest Education Fellowship and how did you become involved? Why did you become involved?
Yeah, I mean, I can get started. So the Voices for Honest Education, it's like a collection of state teachers of the year, all of whom are frustrated with what's happening right now across the country when it comes to what we're calling anti-honest education. Think like the book bans, the education gag orders. And what we're trying to do is just focus on engaging media, engaging legislators or policymakers, and then first and foremost, I should have said, you know, engaging teachers, educators around what it means to do this work in this kind of climate. And a lot of that work is about not necessarily pushing back against the sort of negative talking points that what we're calling the opposition is trying to push forth around why we shouldn't talk about race and identity in the classroom. But on its flip side, more talking about the importance of an honest education. And so inclusive teaching practices, student-affirming pedagogical practices, those that help students reach their full potential, not just as scholars, but also as people.
Yes, I will add that as we do this work, we know that sometimes educators feel really frustrated and they don't feel supported. They feel as though they are doing this work in isolation by themselves. And that even if in some cases, if they do this work in the way that they know kids need them to do the work, that they will get in trouble for it. So we're here to be a support for those teachers, to create resources, to give them everything that they need to feel confident to give students exactly what they need in the classroom space so that they build welcoming learning environments. Because we know that you can be the best English teacher, science teacher, math teacher, and if that environment is not what it should be, then students are not going to engage. And so this fellowship answers that call that we hear from teachers.
How do you define what is an honest education?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mentioned this earlier. It's about teaching practices that are inclusive. It's those that understand where a student is coming from and affirms who they are, right? It's like a catch-all term for every evidence-based teaching practices that help develop critical thinking skills, that help them understand that there are multiple perspectives that center empathy and curiosity, that allow them to become strong members of their community, right? Involved members of their community. And so I was an English teacher. I think Monica, you were one as well. So you'd agree with this. One great example from an ELA humanities perspective is ensuring that we have diverse texts, right? Those that aren't just about the white male literary canon, but really look at other voices, other authors and perspective subjects that have been historically marginalized or erased, and making like those relevant in the classroom in a way that connects the community so that kids have windows and mirrors to see other folks' lives and identities reflected as windows, right? But also have mirrors, their own identities and perspectives reflected back to them so that that informs their understanding of who they are.
Well, to me, that sounds so logical, so reasonable, so responsible. It's hard to fathom why anyone would push against that. But, you know, not everyone who listens to the Up Close podcast is an educator in the classroom. We have a wide listening audience. And, you know, there's some who are listening and who may not really know what educators are up against as they try to bring forth an honest education. Can you talk a little bit about some of what you're hearing from teachers around the country?
Yes, absolutely. So we are trying to engage as many educators as we possibly can, from those who are pre-service all the way to those who are veteran teachers who've been in it for a really long time. And what we're hearing from all of those groups is that they are unsure of what to do. We know that these divisive concepts bills, as they're called, are written to be vague so that teachers don't really know what they can and cannot teach. We know that teachers mm-hmm. have had to remove their classroom libraries because of gag orders, because of book bans. In my state of Texas, we have banned more books than any other state. And I think we are at over almost 2,000 books that are no longer allowed in Texas schools anymore mm-hmm. because of these bans. And so teachers know that students mm-hmm. need to be able to, as TK said, read diverse texts to be able to talk to each other. And so what they're saying is that they're censoring themselves because their livelihood is at stake, that they could face reprimand mm-hmm. from their board and they may not have a job and they need that job. And so we know that things that students need to do, teachers are cutting down on those discussions. They're deciding to go with, you know, a book about a teddy bear instead of a book about an actual issue that students may be facing. There's nothing wrong with teddy bears, uh-huh. but mm. students are not able to have these conversations with each other that we know that they need to have. And so teachers are frustrated. And TK and I had an opportunity to talk to pre-service teachers a couple of weeks ago. And in that conversation, some of them questioned whether or not this was the right profession for them. They said, we're about to go into this in the fall, and now we have second mm-hmm. thoughts about whether or not this was the right profession. Now, by the end of the conversation, they felt a lot better. But these are all concerns that from veteran all the way to before they even walk in the door, these pre-service teachers are really scared to do the things that we know are affirming for our students. And as you said, Sarah, it should uh-huh. be logical that we do this. But we now have teachers who are skilled, who are trained, questioning what they know to be best practices.
Mm. You know, I just want to like also make no mistake, the people who are disproportionately being impacted by these kind of laws, this kind of rhetoric and culture of fear are educators of color, right? LGBTQ+ educators. It's not just the curriculum, right? And the lack of what we can teach or what we can teach that's being mandated by elected officials that's problematic. But as a gay teacher of color, right, it's because these efforts, right, our political efforts to silence people and students, right, who are different. And so there are states where teachers can talk about, if you're gay, what they did over the holidays without fear of repercussion. They can be disciplined mm-hmm. for recognizing a student's gender identity and calling them by their preferred pronoun, right, if it doesn't align with their sex at birth. And there are teachers who might lose their job for having a book in a classroom library that happens to have an LGBTQ+ subject matter. And so it's not just like about who is being taught, but no, what is being taught, it's also an attack on who is being taught.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am so glad that this fellowship program is addressing these needs and concerns. But I'm wondering, you know, where else are you seeing support around the country for teaching truth? Are you working in partnership and fellowship with others addressing these issues?
Yes, we are. One of the things I will tell you, Sarah, that I did not know before this fellowship is that there are coalitions in every state doing this work. And they are coordinated. They're watching the bills. They're making sure that educators in their state have all of this information. And before the fellowship, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm happy to join this group of educators because there are so few, is what I said. There are so few people out here doing this work. When I learned that there are coalitions all over the country who also are sort of like little fellowships, and these coalitions are made up of educators, of attorneys, of community members, of parents who are all working together to make sure that we center students in our classrooms and that practices are affirming and that we vote against these bad bills. I did not know that. So we've been working in conjunction with these fellowships, with these coalitions, I'm sorry, throughout the fellowship. And that's been a really heartening and rewarding part of the work, because the work can get really disheartening. It can be hard and isolating.
You know, Monica mentioned educator groups. We've been working with colleges. We've been working with the Teacher of the Year Network. And then most recently, right, the National Association for Family, School, and Community Engagement, NAFSCE, they're also a group that is very alarmed with what's happening, but from a parent perspective. And that's a partnership that's, I think, worth highlighting, because when it comes to this anti-honest education movement, there is this narrative that's put forth that parents are the ones who are saying, we don't want these things being taught in classroom. And that can't be further from the truth, right? Teachers, educators, school leaders, and family members have more in common than what divides us. It's just those elected officials and politicians who are trying to create division, who are creating a very different misconception. But when you look down the lines of what educators want, what family members want, it's that we want kids to be empathetic, to have a sense of self-respect, to reach their full potential, to, you know, grapple with multiple perspectives and develop critical thinking skills. And so, again, when it comes to this work, it's a collective organizing method. And the more we recognize that there are different pockets in educator groups that care about this issue and that we're aligned, I think the greater our impact would be.
Wow, I am so deeply appreciative of hearing and the passion in your voices for advancing justice in and through education. I just want to talk for a second about what might be another kind of truth. And I can only imagine what it is like to do this work with so much at stake and with so many people affected in profound ways. Monica, you talk about people being fearful of losing their livelihood if they say the wrong word or read the wrong book, bring the wrong curriculum. And you are providing extraordinary leadership, the two of you, along with your colleagues who are part of this fellowship. Would you mind if I ask you about your own personal journey and how this work has impacted you?
Yeah, I can start. I'll say that growing up, going to public schools in Memphis, Tennessee, I didn't see very many characters in my books who looked like me. I didn't see my story being told. I didn't have a lot of teachers who honored my voice as a student. It was mostly, let me tell you what this is about, and then you can tell it back to me. And so I know that one of the things that I thought a lot about before I became a teacher was that I wanted to, and I did have some really great teachers, I would say, some great teachers, but I also had spaces where I didn't feel seen and I did not feel heard at all. And I knew that those spaces, those classroom spaces in which I really loved the learning that was happening there, it was because that teacher made me feel seen and heard. And so that was the work that I wanted to make sure that I did as a teacher. I wanted my students to feel seen. I wanted them to feel heard. And for me, I wanted them to grapple with topics that, you know, they're going to have to face. We want to have students to go out into the world and be able to have conversations with their neighbor, with people on the job. And if we're stifling that at the classroom level, how do we ever expect them to go out into the world and be able to converse with, get along with, work beside people of different faiths, of different cultural backgrounds? It makes no sense to me that we would censor a teacher and keep a teacher from doing that work. And so for me, I have tried to make that a part of my work and always making sure that students see, as TK said, the windows and the mirrors, because I didn't always see those things as a little Black girl in Memphis in school. And so I wanted my students of color, my white students as well, to be able to see multiple perspectives. And then being in this fellowship has allowed me to really expand that work and support others as they do that. In light of these educational gag orders, you can still do it. And so that is what I want teachers to know, that even though there may be a ban in your state, you can still do this work. There are ways to do this work, even if you don't have one, right? You may be in a district that has a resolution, you can still do this work. And so it's very important for me as a woman, as a Black woman, as someone from the South, to make sure that I have an open mind and that I'm always supporting teachers to help their students have open minds. And so it's very personal to me because I want to replicate what I know works. I want to help others replicate that.
Thank you so much, Monica. TK, do you want to speak to your experience?
For sure. You know, Sarah, one of the things that, you know, folks who are trying to limit discussions on race and identity in the classroom, one of the things that they claim, right, a lie, is that it's going to make kids feel ashamed about their country. It's going to make kids ashamed of who they are. And that fear is toxic to them. Well, I want to share an example of how it's been the complete opposite for me, right? I, similar to Monica, you know, grew up as a minority in my school district. I was gay. I was an Asian kid in US public schools. And I never saw myself reflected in my learning, in my school community. And so for me, what that meant was that I grew up feeling invisible. I felt a lot of shame around my own race and identity. And if I'm being completely frank, I was mad, right? I was resentful about our country because I felt like it was a country that had a system that was not designed for me, that never even cared about me, right? And that is what the lack of learning around my identity did to me. And it wasn't until I went to college and I started to learn about the full history of the United States that I came to see myself as an integral part of it, right? There was this whole civil rights movement that included AAPI people. There was the Stonewall riots. There was these histories of marginalized groups of people who were being oppressed, but also at the same time, who were working together to fix their country because they love it and because they loved what it stand for. And those were the learning experience that inspired me to become a teacher and to commit a life to making our country better for everyone else. And that is what an honest and inclusive education does. It doesn't make us ashamed of our past. It makes our past guide us to not repeat its mistakes.
Thank you both for being willing to share your own personal journey and how it is so incredibly relevant to the experience of, and like the experience of, millions of students around this country. I want to take a little bit of a turn because, Takaro, you early in the conversation said two things rather quickly I want to revisit. The first was you talked about a student-affirming education, and I do know that the two of you have put out a fantastic report that was called The Student Affirming Education Needed for Our Children and Our Nation's Future. Can you tell our listeners what that report was all about? And in particular, what are you defining also as a student affirming education?
It's so much, right? Monica, do you want to start and I can jump in, or I could jump
sure,
in?
Sure. I'm happy to start. I'm happy to take that one, Sarah. So I'll say the definition, right? So what we hold near, what we sort of post on our virtual wall when we say student affirming is that when a student shows up to any classroom in this country, they should be able to show up and it doesn't matter who they are, where they're from, what their identity is, that school, that teacher, that classroom space should be one in which they are honored. Their identities are affirmed. Their backgrounds are affirmed. We see their assets and not their deficits. We see that they have skills and that they are at a point where they all can grow. So we want to make sure that when students show up, we're not automatically looking at the fact that they're from this community that doesn't have this money or they're from wherever they're from, but they're an individual and that as an individual, they deserve respect from kindergarten all the way beyond, right? They deserve respect from the adults in there and they deserve care and that those adults who plan lessons for them, who plan activities for them, think of them as individuals as they are planning and they're planning around the students who are in their spaces. So you're always taking care of the students who are in your space. That's what we mean by student affirming. So those books that are diverse, those opportunities to talk to each other, giving them an opportunity to talk to us, building our relationships with them and letting that be the foundation for us then building on content afterwards. So affirming who they are as human beings and centering them instead of centering the content. I remember becoming a teacher and having a teacher say to me, who I really respected, you know, I just really wish you would do something else because you're just so smart and teaching is not the way to go. And that blew my mind, right? And I always thought that she was a person who loved the profession and she talked, and this was in the 80s, maybe. We'll see. I graduated in 93, but this was like early 90s. And she told me that it wasn't the way to go. And I thought that she had built such an affirming space and wanted to do that. And so even within this profession, right, we have teachers who, you know, we're doing the work, but all of the pressures, even in the 90s, and now here we are 2023, still with these same pressures, trying to build these student affirming spaces, but they're hard, but they're necessary. And so, yeah, that's what we mean. Sorry, that was long. TK.
No, terrific. Go ahead, TK.
Yeah, Sarah, I try to avoid sort of getting into the nitty-gritty of what student-affirming education is, because there's a lot of buzzwords, right? And I can list a couple of them off. I think of student-affirming education as, you know, those that are attentive to the social-emotional needs of our students, those that are culturally mm-hmm. responsive and relevant to the students' community and their identities, those that center principles around diversity, equity, and inclusion, and understand that those are core principles and a lens through which learning can happen. And so that when you're reading the text, you're not just looking at it through one perspective, but you're comparing and contrasting with multiple other perspectives. Now, the reasons why I sort of try to move away from delving into the specific pedagogical implications and practices is because, like how Monica much better explained, it's better when we understand it as its effects and as a general approach to teaching. And it's just an approach to teaching that says, hey, when we are teaching you because we care about you, right? More than just a scholar or a number, but as an individual who is part of a larger community. And so for me, when I think about what a student affirming education at its core, using that similar approach, is that, you know, you teach about race, you teach about, you know, issues, gender, class, the highs and highs of our country, the lows and lows of our country. But at its core, student affirming education is a pedagogy of empathy, right? Something that leans into our shared humanity, the common purpose that we have, the respect and the curiosity, right, that we should be having for those that are different between us. And when a child leaves the classroom with that pedagogy of empathy, right, grounded in a love and a humanity, right, a sense of humanity, that is a power that you can't take away.
Mm-hmm. I love what you've just said. And, you know, again, so many of these ideas that you're putting forward and actions that you're taking are just born out of logic and reason from my perhaps limited perspective, admittedly, but seems so straightforward to me. But I also can imagine that, you know, for an educator who grasps this idea and whose imagination is fired by it and who wants to improve his or her practice, where do educators get support for that? You know, we might assume this is just something that we're just, but we're all born with empathy. We're all born with these capabilities, these characteristics, but we know that our own personal development can always be further cultivated. So where do educators turn for that opportunity?
Yeah, we would hope that, and what I hope is that one day when teachers, future teachers are studying to be really good educators, that they're getting that at the pre-service level. We know that that happens in some places, mm-hmm. in some places it does not. And so when it does not happen, what I've told teachers is that sometimes that learning will come from the people around them, from their professional learning communities within their schools. And sometimes it doesn't come from that either. You may find yourself in a school and you're trying to center students' experiences and you're trying to make sure that your students are affirmed in who they are, but maybe that's not happening on a large scale around you. And that is when we reach outside, we connect with educators and other groups. You'll find so many resources. I am not a great person to use Twitter. Like I'm trying, I'm learning, but I have found so many resources in just social settings, social media type settings, where there are free webinars, there are free trainings, there are things that teachers can sign up for, mm-hmm. and they're led by educators who have been in the classroom, who are in the classroom still, who are just trying to help. And so like that is why we joined this fellowship, and I'm speaking for TK too, is because we've had some success and we want to see others have success. So those resources are out there. If they don't exist in your school, then join those coalitions. Teachers are busy and you're in the classroom and there are 1,000 things that can happen in one class period, and you're trying to eat lunch, answer emails, and do all these things, and you may not have a chance to pay attention to some bill that a legislator just proposed. But those coalitions around you will send out bullets of information to help you know what's happening. And so those coalitions, local educator groups, social media, joining the right groups there, that's where you get your fuel. That's where you find out where the free things are. And that's where you as an educator can also be affirmed.
Thank you so much for that. I hope that that has inspired many of our listeners. You know, another thing I'd like to just quickly get into, if you've listened to any of our previous podcasts, you know that the NEA Foundation and the Up Close podcast are big proponents of family, school, and community partnership. And we really feel that we're all a part of an education community. So when you talk about student affirming education and teaching truth to students, can you talk a little bit about the role of parents and what parents can do in both of these respects?
I think parent and family engagement is student affirming education, right? Like if you're not engaging and if you're not incorporating the community as part of the students' learning experience, then it's not student affirming. And so I'll say that like engagement of family is part of student affirming. I'll also say this, right? There is, again, that conception that parents and students are oftentimes against each other when we know that, you know, it's further from the truth, right? If there's any silver lining in part of what's frustrating about, you know, this anti-honest education movement, well, that silver lining is that the majority does have our backs, right? By and large, families and parents, they are for the core principles of an honest education, meaning that they want their children to reach full potential. They want their kids to feel accepted and respect other people. They want kids to be able to work with children and people from different backgrounds, right? And they don't like book bans. They don't like education gag orders. They're sick and tired of elected officials also meddling in our local school communities. And so when educators, school leaders, and then parents and families are able to just align around what they share and can have a communication that centers what they care about for the students first and foremost, then I think we can overcome a lot of that political debate and noise that's being perpetuated oftentimes by the media and really lean in to that collective power that centers what is best for students and advocate unapologetically for our public good, for our common good, and our public schools.
Wonderfully, wonderfully stated. And it's also a bit of a good segue. I'm always amazed at how quickly our time goes. And as the eternal optimist, because that actually enables me to continue my work from day to day, I like to inspire that optimism in others as well. Where do you find hopefulness? What are some bright spots you might point to as you wrestle with these very difficult topics that you've talked about today? What makes you hopeful?
For me, Sarah, I will say that I get so much joy in seeing in a teacher's face that determination to still do this work in spite of. I was in a meeting the other day with some teachers from Howard University, and they were fired up. And they said, you know what? We're not going to leave the profession. We're going to see what we can do to make this better for ourselves and to make it better for educators who are coming behind us, who are in school now, who don't have that degree yet, but they're still hoping to be in the classroom in the fall. So when they feel as though they find that crack and where they can still do this work in an affirming way for students, and that aha moment where they're like, okay, this is the bill, but this is still how I can support my students. When they can still see and figure out with our support or from somebody else's support, how they can still do the work and that they have ideas for how to grow in the work, that's what gives me hope. And what gives me hope also is the young generation of students who we have who are recognizing that this legislation that is being written or has been already passed in so many states is not what they need, that they recognize that they do have to learn about diverse perspectives. And they're using their voices to get out, whether that is through interviews, through, you know, a school walkout to get attention, or showing up at a school board meeting and also, you know, speaking at that school board meeting. When students at K-12 level, when they're showing up and doing that work, I also have hope, because those are the people who will be future teachers. And we need that line of thinking for those who are coming into the profession. So I get hope in those two spaces.
Agreed. It's that teachers, educators are the best, right? We're solution finders and we're problem solvers. But we also suffer oftentimes from imposter syndrome. And, you know, Monica and I have been in a lot of educator spaces, political spaces, and we know for a fact that a lot of the decisions that are being made on behalf of us oftentimes don't have a teacher at the seat at the table. And when I see these recommendations and guidelines and sometimes even legislation and policy being passed, oftentimes without the people who have the most credibility and expertise and talent, in other words, the teachers, it makes my blood boil, right? And so the thing that gives me hope is the recognition that when it comes to the educator core, we have the lived experience, we have the credibility, we have the proximity to our school communities that make us the most qualified to be opining on and forming the conversation and discourse around education policy issues. And as long as we, you know, and we're just a step away from truly tapping into that potential. And when we do that, and when we do that in a collective way, I know we're going to be able to push back against so much of what's happening right now. And believing in that is what's giving me hope.
Excellent, excellent. And I know that a part of what you've already shared throughout this broadcast has touched somewhat on my next question. But in each of the Up Close podcasts, we also like to speak to those policymakers who might be listening in on the various subjects that we discuss. And so if you were able to give recommendations to some of the policymakers in this country around the kinds of topics that we've discussed in this past few minutes, what might those be?
Wow. There is so much to say. I will say that, you know, to TK's point about educators not being at the table, there has been so much bad legislation that has been passed where no teacher was consulted. And when we think about HR 5, right, this parents' bill of rights, parents and teachers are not being consulted. When we look at those five pillars, those things already exist. And so I wish legislators knew that it is important to stop trying to create bills that create dissension. We are, through HR 5, through the parents' bill of rights, we're saying that there must be some type of, you know, some type of rub between teachers and parents, because if there weren't, we wouldn't need this bill of rights, right? We're going to have this anti-critical race theory or this educational gag order because teachers must be doing things in the wrong way. We get talked at and not talked to. We get, you know, left out and not brought in. And so I would recommend that they spend some time, not just in classrooms, but to talk to teachers, talk to families, go visit communities and find out what we need. 86% of parents believe that legislators are putting their hands on too much of what's happening in the classrooms and they do not like it. Yet we are still going back to the drawing board, copying, pasting bad bills, not thinking about what our constituents need, and not taking into consideration what students are saying, what educators are saying, and what parents are saying as we go to the drawing board and we create new bad bills. So please talk to educators, talk to parents, talk to students, and don't just, and also be diverse in who you talk to, because the parents' bill of rights, for example, the parents that they're talking to, that's not a representative swath of the parents across this nation. You're talking to one small segment and you're allowing them to make policy for parents who are not even at the table. And so listen, stop, take a minute and stop with all of these executive orders before we have conversations with real people who are doing this work.
I was a student of New Jersey Public Schools. I taught at Massachusetts. And so there are a lot of, you know, blue state policymakers, legislators that I came into contact with who care about this work, but maybe are a little bit hesitant to lean into it because of the sort of political noise that's been created around it. So to those policymakers, I'd say, you know, do you want our kids to have the college and career readiness skills to become contributing members of society? Do you want them to feel accepted and respected, respectful of other people? Do you want them to reach their full potential? If you said yes to any or all of these, congratulations, you are already a proponent of honest education and therefore, right, lean into those values when you're advocating for teachers. Come to our classrooms, right, speak to an educator, and then listen to the students of what they care about. And then everything else would sort itself out.
Wonderful, wonderful response. Thank you so much for that, both Monica and TK, for your thoughts. You know, lastly, I think I would say that on the Up Close podcast, as throughout the NEA Foundation, we also believe that everyone can be a contributor to positive change in preserving public education. And so you've just spoken powerfully to policymakers, but we believe everyone has a role to play. So if you are going to issue a call to action of sorts to our listening audience, very diverse listening audience, as pertains to teaching truth, affirming students, person, whole personhood, and all the many things that you've discussed today, what would that call to action be?
I think the first thing to always remember is that, you know, there's a lot, regardless of our race, our gender, or political background, most people, especially those who are being in these conversations in good faith, want what's best for our children. I've talked about what those are, right? We want our kids to reach their full potential. We want them to be able to work with kids from different backgrounds. And so as long as if we're able to focus in on that goodness, right, that universal goodness that we want for our children, even when we're having politically tense conversations, right, by focusing on that value, right, and centering our collective goals and demonstrating that what's happening in our schools are either threatening or helping, right, achieve those values, I think we can accomplish a lot together.
Yeah, I'll add that.
Monica, did you want to speak to that?
Sure. As I talk to, you know, family members or friends who maybe don't have children in public schools, they may not be as well versed on what's happening. It may be a part of the news they sort of skip over. But my advice to anyone listening who, you know, you may not feel that connection to the community because your kids are all graduated and, you know, you're done and you don't really, you know, go to the school for events or check out what's happening, is that we should still take a little bit of time to pay attention to what's happening, because this is, if we're not affirming students, if we are not promoting honest education in our schools, if we're not paying attention to efforts to silence teachers and to silence students, then we are affecting our future democracy. We're going to have a democracy of students who don't know their own history, can't speak to their own history. They are not probably going to be the best citizens they can be because they haven't learned to appreciate diverse perspectives. And these are the people who will be taking care of all of us. And so we want them to go into the world being able to do that, to see people as people, to see people as, you know, see diversity as a beautiful thing, see different perspectives as a way to challenge themselves and to learn a little bit more. And so if we're not involved in the schools because we don't have kids currently in school right now, that is okay. Still pay attention and keep an ear to it, because we're keeping an ear to what our democracy is going to look like in the future. And so pay attention, still vote education, vote for public education, vote for those who support it, because when you do that, you're voting for a better democracy.
Hear, hear. What a wonderful, wonderful closing to this podcast. Thank you so much, TK and Monica, not only for your time today, but your forthrightness, the work that you are doing. Just fabulous. And I know that this podcast is going to evoke a tremendous response from our listening audience. Just all the best to you and everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Up Close podcast today. These are the kinds of conversations that we engage in all of the time. And we'd love it if you would subscribe to our podcast. You can do that wherever you tune into podcasts, and look for our advertisement with respect to our next episode. Look forward to seeing you then. Bye-bye, everyone.